Martin is again another amazing person. I call him the owl because, do you remember that we have innate sleep rhythms in us? There are those people who get up early, they're larks. There are those people who are boring in the morning, don't get going until midday, and then won't go to bed. They're owls. Martin's an owl. Martin worked for the BBC, and I've had a long association with Martin. He worked for the World Service, in sitting in front of his microphone and saying one or two things into it. And it's amazing how many people listen to the World Service. They will call you up and say, "Yes, I heard you last night." I thought, but you shouldn't, it's the World Service. And you four people are in crew. Hardly the world. They're certainly owls, because, of course, the World Service goes on at night. And Martin is a most amazing person. He's totally competent in anything to do with sound. He's done all the sound here. And those of you who know Taverner, and Taverners Towards Silence, will know that Martin has been at work, because it was in Salisbury Cathedral that they had a huge, huge Tibetan bell, which the piece calls for, and a bowl, rather. And this was right up in the rafters of Winchester. He placed his microphones delicately so as to get the sound which radiated out. So, Martin, it's a really great pleasure to have you here, and again, to thank you for everything that you've done.
Thank you very much, Peter. You could be forgiven for accusing me of stalking you. I think when I turned up at the Study Society as a new graduate and trainee meditator in about 1976, you were already a senior member here and active in several groups. I then started making radio programs and wheeled you in at any excuse, because you were somehow talking about consciousness in a way that all those reductionists didn't talk about. You never used the phrase "nothing but a." And then I joined the Scientific and Medical Network. In fact, I think you probably twisted my arm to join the Scientific and Medical Network, at which stage you were chairman of that. Now you're president of that. I came back here on the management committee, and we managed to persuade you to be chairman of that. I keep following you around, and usually I do my utmost to stay the other side of the microphones and look after the sound and so on. Over the next 10 minutes, you might find out why. But David persuaded me that somebody had to come and talk about non-duality. Now, non-duality is something you can't really talk about, because really it's about becoming one, and words define and separate. It's a bit like trying to pin non-duality down is a bit like trying to nail jelly to the wall. And perhaps at this stage in the afternoon, having foregone your tea break and looking forward to what is to follow, perhaps your brains are turning to jelly by now anyway. And, you know, we've had a lot of very eminent scientists. You've heard lots of words. So I was wondering, what can I talk about? And I drew my inspiration from wonderful Marilyn Monk over there, another illustrious scientist, who, in spite of being a pioneer of epigenetics and professor at UCL, describes herself as having three aspects to herself. One is the scientist. Well, we've had plenty of great scientists today. Another is a mystic. Yeah, that would be good, but what does a mystic do? I think he probably just sits there quietly and you'd probably all go to sleep. So let's pass that over for now. But you also describe yourself as a poet. So as a way of trying to convey a bit about non-duality without using just the speech centres in the left hemisphere, I'm going to read a couple of poems. The problem with words is that they do define things and separate things. And my journey through the Study Society particularly has been trying to get away from that. A good breakthrough on that journey came actually at a conference that I think Peter encouraged me to go to, along with our dear friend William Anderson, no longer with us, at Olympia, not the exhibition centre over the road, but in Greece. And Max mentioned Emilios Bourotinos, lovely Greek gentleman who describes himself as an essayist. And he sent us out on a little practical workshop on this conference. He was doing a workshop on myth interpretation, and he sent us out to sit in silence among the olive trees and think about what a favourite myth meant to us. And I picked the story of Adam and Eve, which I'd struggled with a lot as someone who's rather fond of evolutionary biology and don't agree with the creationists, really. And that has still been one of the abiding realisations on the tree to understanding non-duality for me. I thought I'd made a really original breakthrough. I then discovered that it was all written up in much greater detail by Bede Griffiths in one of his books, and it wasn't an original thought, but it came to me from somewhere. And that is, what is the story of Adam and Eve actually about? And I don't mean all the sexist stuff with the woman and the serpent and so on. I mean, what is the tree of knowledge? What is it that we eat from and fall from the Garden of Eden, fall from paradise? And I think that's an allegory for the evolution of speech. Because once you call something by a name, that is a tree. Oh, okay, that is a tree. That is not me. I am this. That is that. We're separate. And that is the beginning of non-duality. To rise above that feeling of duality, you have to experience non-duality. You know the one about the Dalai Lama who walked into a pizza restaurant and said, "Make me one with everything." Somehow, we've got to get there. Now, I'm not guaranteeing an experience of oneness, but I've got some nice poems that might help. One of them, and all of these you're probably familiar with, but hey. There are those things. Dr. Rolls, who founded the society, described the moments where one feels oneness without any sustaining technique. One just finds these moments, like picking up £5 in the gutter. They're wonderful when you find them, but you can't make a living from them. And you can get the flavour of them from that lovely poem by W.B. Yeats, which I'm sure you're all familiar with. I sat a solitary man in a crowded London shop, an open book and empty cup on the marble tabletop. While on the shop and street I gazed, my body of a sudden blazed, and 20 minutes, more or less, it seemed so great, my happiness, that I was blessed and could bless. We all know those moments, but we need to make more of them. We need not to dwell on the ones that have gone past. When the society started out, when Uspensky talked about self-remembering, when we were first taught about the Advaita or non-dual system by the Shankaracharya, it was almost a secret code. It was something you didn't actually talk about in public. Now, non-duality is everywhere. There are non-duality meet-up groups that attract hundreds of people. Many of them meet in this room. There are people who have had great realizations. There are other people who haven't and think they have. One of the people who I think has made very substantial progress, and who I'm pleased to say started here and now has carved his own path as a non-dualist, is Jeff Foster. And just a little warning from something that he wrote about not dwelling on those £5 notes you find in the street, not dwelling on W.B. Yeats's single experience. In his case, he was talking about a mystical moment when he was gazing out on the ocean. He said, "You saw the ocean yesterday. Wonderful. But can that ocean be seen in these waves? Can you recognize who you really are in this moment? Can you be at peace now? Why cling to a memory of yesterday's awakening? Yes, if we are truly interested in the end of suffering, we must go beyond all personal stories of our own awakening, all images of ourselves, and all boasts and claims about our own evolution, to a deep and radical acceptance of this moment. Awakening is the easy part. Holding on to a story of yesterday's awakening is the easy part. Telling stories about your past is the easy part, but nobody and nothing, being nobody and nothing, is the easy part. The real adventure begins when you're willing to lose all stories, including those stories of your own spiritual transformation, your own specialness, your own purity, and be totally naked in front of life. The real adventure begins where all personal specialness ends." So back to the problem of words. Another person who we have whole study groups on here is Jalaluddin Rumi, who devised the whirling dervish ceremony, which is practiced in this room. He wrote, "Define and narrow me, you starve yourself of yourself. Nail me down in a box of cold words, that box is your coffin. I do not know who I am. I am not a Christian, I am not a Jew, I am not a Zoroastrian, I am not even a Muslim. I do not belong to the land or any known or unknown sea. Nature cannot own or claim me, nor can heaven, nor can India, China, Bulgaria. My birthplace is placelessness. My sign to have and give no sign. You say you see my mouth, ears, eyes, nose. They are not mine. I am the life of life. I am that cat, this stone, no one. I have thrown duality away like an old dish rag. I see and know all times and worlds as one, one, always one. So what do I have to do to get you to admit who is speaking? Admit it and change everything. This is your own voice echoing off the walls of God." Words are the products of brains. So are brains the problem? Well, no, because brain goes bigger than Broca's area and the speech centres and all that stuff. Brains are not just the left hemisphere. I prefer the term mind to brain because that goes even further. But I think this morning you mentioned, was it you or was it Max, who mentioned how in perception we can take in the whole sky. I wondered if that phrase came from this poem, and I thank Kirsten for bringing this to my attention a few years ago. Again, a poem you know by Emily Dickinson. "The brain is wider than the sky, for put them side by side, the one the other will include, with ease and you beside. The brain is deeper than the sea, for hold them blue to blue, the one the other will absorb as sponges buckets do. The brain is just the weight of God, for lift them pound for pound, and they will differ, if they do, a syllable from sound." So, let's go beyond words. What is it that the brain can do beyond words? Well, there's perception. Is it perception that feeds consciousness and nourishes it? Certainly feeds and nourishes memory, which is a big component of everyday consciousness. Many have described the process of subject-object consciousness. I think you said you'd hope I'd talk about that a bit later now. I don't really understand what it is, so I'm not going to talk about it. I'm going to read something from Rupert Spira, who we saw in Peter's little video this morning. I'm afraid I'm a sound man, so you don't get pictures with me. But Rupert, who is another non-duality person who began in this house and has carved a very exciting track for himself now, he wrote this. The sensation of the wind on our face is one single sensation. However, thinking conceptualizes it as two. Thinking fragments this single sensation into two apparent objects, the wind and the face. In fact, it is one. We could call this new sensation wind face. The division of wind face into wind and face is a conceptual division that seemingly divides experience into a face, me, and the wind, not me. As a result, the person and the world seem to become two distinct and independent entities or objects. In this way, the seamless intimacy of experience is fragmented into two apparent parts, an inside self and an outside object, other or world, which are imagined to be joined together by an act of knowing, feeling, or perceiving. Hence we say, I know such and such. I feel the wind. I love you. I see the tree. However, in the seeing of a tree, for instance, there is no seer and there is no seen. There is no inside eye that sees and there is no outside tree that is seen. The eye and the tree are concepts superimposed by thinking onto the reality of the experience, which in this case could simply be called seeing. It's thinking alone that divides the seamless intimacy of experiencing into a subject and an object, into an eye that sees and a tree that is seen. However, awareness, or I, and the reality of the tree are not two separate experiences. They are one. I and tree are one experience in the same way that the wind and the face are one experience. There is never a subject or an object of experience. There's always only seamless, intimate experiencing. So, the tree as a separate entity vanishes, much more alarmingly to those of us who try and hang on to it. So does I. So do you. That wonderful Irishman with the less Irish name Wei Wu Wei wrote, admittedly in words, there is no self and no other. There is no wrong desire, no anger, no hatred, no victory, no failure. Renounce conceptual thought processes and your nature will exhibit pristine purity. Even Wittgenstein said, there is no such thing as the self that thinks and entertains ideas. Lin Qin in 9th century China wrote, make the slightest distinction and heaven and earth are set apart. If you hold on to opposites, how can you know one? If there's no self, no subject, no object, no separate heaven and earth, what is there? I'm not sure if this is a saying that you quoted the Shankaracharya in or if it's something that you said, but you didn't attribute properly. But you said, mind is by nature blissful. We just need to be quiet to experience it. So if I'm not the observer, if I'm not the subject, who am I? I want to end with a quote that everyone who comes regularly to study society meetings, as I hope all of you will before long, will be very familiar with. It's probably the most read quote from the Shankaracharya, Santanand Saraswati, in answer to that question, who am I? If you begin to be what you are, you will realize everything. But to begin to be what you are, you must come out of what you are not. You are not those thoughts which are turning, turning in your mind. You are not those changing feelings. You are not the different decisions you make and the different wills you have. You are not that separate ego. Well then, what are you? You will find, when you have come out of what you are not, that the ripple on the water is whispering to you, I am that. The birds in the trees are singing to you, I am that. The moon and the stars are shining beacons to you, I am that. You are in everything in the world, and everything in the world is reflected in you, and at the same time, you are that everything. Thank you.
Martin, thank you so much. It's a beautiful demonstration of non-duality. Thank you so much. And I can see that you should spend much more time behind the microphone than just behind the desk.